Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, on AM/FM stations across the states, and also we've got a few little affiliate networks in the Uber Kingdom and New Zealand. And I hope someday we'll have real radio stations all over the globe that plug into the Vinnie Eastwood show, so that we can bring on activists from every corner of the globe to put a spotlight and make that activist kind of famous, garner them support. Because it's not just me that needs donations. Mate, do you have any idea what an activist goes through in the day-to-day machinations of exposing just a little bit of scumbaggery? It's quite the challenge. It's a very tough job, because it's a full-time job at less than minimum wage. It's rough, mate. It's worse than NAFTA or GATT. Today we have a very interesting man, I'm sure. His name is John Potash. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Vinny.
Can you just tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Yeah, I work as a counselor. I do counseling for a living, and I'm a freelance writer on the side. But I've been working for about two decades on two different books, and the main book, of course, I'm going to be talking about today is the FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. And I also happen to have published a national graduate school newspaper called Social Justice Action Quarterly, which I sold in bulk to professors at 25 schools around the country, and was working on this book for about a decade and a half. I did my graduate school studies at Columbia University, and my newspaper happened to win awards every year from the Campus Alternative Journalism Awards, and basically it about me.
You sound like a very, very dedicated dude, because if you're going to work on something for, a decade and a half?
Yeah, about that.
You've got a long concentration span, don't you, mate?
I guess so.
Well, that's good, because what I don't know an awful lot about is Tupac Shakur, and I don't know an awful lot about specifically how the FBI and COINTELPRO operates in the United States, or has done, or still is. So I'd actually, I'm quite glad to have you here, because you'd be able to elucidate a little on that.
Well, thanks. Well, basically, I found out about this from first working on a political novel based, and one of my characters was based on one of the people I was counseling. He said, when I was doing drug counseling in Baltimore City, and my person I was counseling said my father was a Black Panther killed by the police. I investigated the Panthers for a character in this novel and found that the Shakurs were the leading New York Black Panthers. And so then in just before, at the end of 1994, I saw an article in the Washington Post that said another strange twist, the same police officers that first showed up at Tupac's alleged sexual abuse scene a year before showed up when he was shot in a New York recording studio lobby. And so they had found, this writer had said there was a number of strange aspects of police foul play around Tupac's trial, around that sexual abuse case. And so I called Tupac's New York trial lawyer and said, do you think that they're targeting him like they're targeting his Black Panther parents? And he said, yes, and no one's writing about it. So he gave me a two-hour interview about the subject, and he was a serious activist himself. He was the European spokesperson for the Mumia Abu-Jamal campaign. And so I ended up publishing an article locally on the fact that, asking, is there a new COINTELPRO, a FBI counterintelligence program, targeting Tupac like they targeted his Black Panther parents? And so then finally, a number of years later, about 3 years later, 4 years later, I published an article in a national magazine called Covert Action Quarterly, which was started by a CIA whistleblower, Phil Agee. And that included some 50 end notes to the article. And once I got that out, people all around Tupac opened up in a huge way to me and said, you got to turn this into a book. So what I found was that Tupac was only pretending to be this gangster in order to appeal to gangs and politicize them. That was his hidden agenda. And his Black Panther family, his extended family, were creating gang peace truces around the country, getting Bloods and Crips, notorious gangs, to stop fighting each other and start fighting against racism and start working on community organizing. And it was
in other words, he was a peaceful, benevolent, infiltrating manipulator.
You could call him that in some sense. In the sense, he was just living he was only pretending to be something that he wasn't completely. And people could tell that from his music, because he had a lot of activist messages in his music along with his gangsta lyrics. So, it was a hidden plan in that regard. But I don't think he was trying to manipulate for a bad reason. I think he was trying to, manipulate in a good way to try to get these gang members to turn into activism. And they were, the heads of Bloods gang in L.A. actually went to England to speak in Manchester and in London to a black socialist group called Panther there. So they were very serious, as was Monster Cody Scott, who changed his name to Sonika Shakur on behalf of Tupac and his stepfather Mutulu Shakur. And he was a former gang leader in L.A. who had written the best-selling novel Monster and had turned socialist and become a serious, political activist.
Wow, man.
Yeah, so
have you noticed every single big story or every single death of somebody famous or whatever, there's always an underlying story that the mainstream media just never tells you about?
Well, I don't know about everyone, but the ones that, that I've put in print, I definitely believe so. And so that's why the subtitle of my book is U.S. Intelligence's Murderous Targeting of Tupac, MLK, Malcolm, Panthers, Hendrix, Marley, Rappers, and Linked Ethnic Leftists. Because I basically argue that when you analyze Tupac and his Shakur family and the tactics used against them and the personnel used against them, you find an overlap between similar tactics and personnel that were used against all these other people I mentioned in that subtitle.
What specific tactics are we talking about here? Like in somebody's everyday life, what would be different for Tupac Shakur in relation to FBI, COINTELPRO than me?
Well, the cover up alone is some of it. For example, in Atlanta, which I show was the fourth attempt on his life with evidence that U.S. intelligence was involved, there was supposedly off-duty white police officers that witnesses, when I got to the Atlanta newspapers to find out exactly what the witnesses said and what they printed in the Atlanta newspapers that was said at the trial, both white and black witnesses said that these white, supposedly off-duty cops ran up to Tupac's car and shot at him for no reason. Okay, they shot first, basically. And now, witnesses that I interviewed personally said that they actually smashed his window with the butt of their gun, a gun that was stolen from a police evidence locker, shot at him. Tupac rolled out the back, grabbed the security guard's gun, and got down on one knee and shot back and hit them in the butt and thigh as they started retreating, because a lot of people got out of their cars, a lot of bodyguards got out of their cars behind Tupac. So, you know, when you see things like that, when you get that, and what the mainstream media has originally said was that Tupac shot at these, you know, these white cops, these racist cops, but he shot these cops first because he saw them beating on a black man nearby. So when you get to the primary sources and you get to, you know, in a lot of these situations, that's what's found. And it's come out in movies like Nick Broomfield's Biggie and Tupac, for example. The police officer assigned to investigate Biggie Smalls' murder came to find and said it in the movie Biggie and Tupac that, and this was a white high-level police officer named Russell Poole, he said he found that his fellow police officers killed Biggie Smalls in order to cover up their murder of Tupac Shakur. And so when he tried to come out of it, his life was ruined.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Did those police officers by chance get promoted afterwards?
I can't say they all got promoted, but some of them did, you know, get to do things. You know, that is usually the case. In this case, so much evidence came out against those police officers that some were assigned to other, you know, other locations. Some ended up getting the finger pointed at, you know, for other things, because Russell Poole was such a, you know, he was so committed to trying to get this word out that they started something called the Rampart Scandal, in order basically to cover up what he found. And that's what a U.S. Attorney General, a State's Attorney General said, that Russell Poole's investigation started what was called the Rampart Scandal, the largest scandal in L.A. history, they called it. And yet it was a diversion, ended up being a diversion from what he really found, you know, that these police officers were working for Death Row Records, moonlighting for Death Row Records, supposedly. And then his superior, Russell Poole's superior, said to him that you can call them covert agents. So, you know, they were moonlighting for them, and they were killing. They had killed Tupac Shakur and killed Biggie Smalls in order to make Tupac's murder look like a East Coast versus West Coast war. Now, they had done the same thing with the counterintelligence program to the Black Panthers. They created what Kathleen Cleaver called, and Kathleen Cleaver was the national spokesperson for the Black Panthers in the 1960s. She said they created that war between them. They call it the East Coast versus West Coast Panther War. And then undercover agents started shooting people, and they blamed it on, you know, these blacks killing each other. And they used fake letters to do this. They used undercover agents to do this. And I show evidence that they did the same thing with Tupac.
And, of course, what happens is they then have this big problem, which they created. And so they go to the government. They go, hey, guys, we need lots more guns. And
right.
We need to also pass more progressive legislation to make sure nobody has any rights, let alone just gang members.
Right.
We're searching everybody. How about anti-drug laws or something like that? How about we use that to arbitrarily search people?
Sure. Sure. Now, in my next book, I get more into that. I think they really had a problem with these gangs turning into activists and stopping selling drugs, but that's another matter for my next book. But I agree with you completely, Vinny, about that. But, it's incredible. When you talked about an agent getting a promotion after he followed through with an intelligence operation, you look at Martin Luther King Jr. and you find that Merrill McCullough was the black undercover agent that was the first to arrive to at his body, according to William Pepper, who was the Martin Luther King family lawyer. And he said when he wrote two books on Martin Luther King's assassination, saying that it was a government, U.S. intelligence assassination of Martin Luther King. And he actually won a trial that was barely covered in the mainstream media here in 1999. The King family sued and won in court, saying that U.S. intelligence played a major part in assassinating, you know, Martin Luther King. But William Pepper showed that Merrill McCullough was the first to arrive at his body to signal the shooters that the assassination was successful. And then Merrill McCullough got a promotion to the CIA after that. He was originally a military intelligence agent, got promotion to the CIA.
Well, how did he signal that this assassination was okay? Did he like have a big grin ear to ear and two thumbs up?
Well, yeah, William Pepper said he was the only one that wasn't wearing a tie, and he was I don't know what exact signal he gave, but the one of the snipers that was supposed to be a backup sniper in case the first sniper wasn't successful laid it out for one of Pepper's investigators and also showed him the intelligence document for the whole operation, and he published that in his book. Pepper did, and got intelligence people to interpret that document for him. But it is incredible that the guy, whatever signal he gave, he then ends up getting a promotion for the CIA. And the word did get out about this, in the 90s, but nothing was done about it, as far as I know.
It means he must be in line for even bigger promotions in the future.
Possibly. But I argue about...
Because at this point, if you've got that much dirt on somebody, like if you know that they brutally murdered Tupac, for example, uh-huh. You can hold that over somebody forever, and they're your puppet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's done a lot. I agree with that. But it's interesting about McCullough because of the fact that with Malcolm X, the first person to arrive at Malcolm X's body was Eugene Roberts. Eugene Roberts was an undercover intelligence agent himself. Now, so he had infiltrated Malcolm's group. He was the first one to say that, to check his life signs and say it was successful, and just to make sure the assassination was successful, I argue, just the same way McCullough was. And he had brought his wife, Joan Roberts, to that situation where Malcolm was giving the speech before, when he was assassinated. And Joan Roberts grabbed Malcolm's wife, Betty Shabazz, and held her back, and she's a nurse. So they did not let her first arrive to Malcolm's body. He was the first to arrive there. And after he was successful with that, he moved on to be inside the Black Panthers as an undercover agent. And then he testified in a trial against the Black Panthers, and one of those Black Panthers was Fannie Shakur, Tupac's mother. So the Shakur family, you see those kinds of overlapping personnel against the major black leaders that way. And they, of course, tried to frame Fannie Shakur in the Black Panther 21, and Fannie Shakur was a brilliant woman and wasn't college-educated but defended herself in court, and the jurors said that they credit her with getting the whole Panther 21 off in court. They were found not guilty of, 100-plus charges. So,
Can we say unequivocally that the government of the United States and these intelligence agencies and all of these other surveillance society merchandise salesmen like the FBI and the federal police, etc., have a very, very specific racist agenda? And it's very, very clear, especially because they exterminate black people all the time through Planned Parenthood. We'll be right back, folks, in just a few minutes.
Some kind of way out of here. Say the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine. Plowman, dig my earth.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Broadcasting live on the airwaves. Getting a little bit of truth out there. This is the kind of media that actually matters now. Because all of the other type of media that's talking about this and that every 30 seconds so that you don't remember what they were talking about in the first frickin' place, you guessed it, is no longer relevant. Stop listening to it. It's a waste of your freaking time and it's going to rot your brain. Kind of like Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola media. Yeah. Hey, I think that would be a good idea. We have a great big media company that's all Coca-Cola all day. Breaking news! There's new freaking Coca-Cola with even extra aspartame. Scumbags. All right. Well, very special guest, John Potash. I hope you're having fun, mate.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I guess I want to say about Planned Parenthood. I know they started with the eugenics founder, but I was hoping that they didn't stay that way, and because I happen to be a pro-choice, pro-abortion rights. But I'm sorry, yeah, if Planned Parenthood stayed in the eugenics philosophy, that'd be really sad. It could be true, I don't know.
Well, I think it was Bill Gates, you know how much of a big eugenicist he is.
I didn't?
He gives billions of dollars to eugenics programs and sterilizations and vaccinations in Africa and all this other kind of stuff. Really nasty man.
I believe it.
Yeah, he's even admitted that he now wants to geoengineer and spray chemicals over everybody using chemtrails. And he's also incidentally just bought shares in, what's its name? Monsanto. He bought a big chunk of Monsanto. And of course, they've got a track record of being very moral and non-eugenicist, right? And guess who Monsanto also just bought? It just keeps jumping like a little leapfrog, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Blackwater.
Fucking
Blackwater.
Yeah, that's extra ugly. But yeah, I get into one environmentalist in my book. This woman, Judy Barry, was head of Earth First because when a bomb went off under her car in 1990, maybe because she was a white woman, it got huge press, huge backing by some top political leaders when she sued the FBI, and she ended up winning millions of dollars from the FBI. And she researched what happened, found that the evidence said that this Richard Held, this high-level FBI supervisor in San Francisco, resigned early because all the evidence led back to him and a COINTELPRO to kill her for her success in organizing against the lumber industry in the Northwest when she was leading a redwood summer over there. And so she ended up dying early a few years later, but all of her research, did a lot. She actually said when she found out all about the FBI, she said, "I hope the FBI find their man, and when they do, I hope they fire him," about, who was behind her bombing. So she, because of her, we find out that Held was behind unbelievable stuff. Now, he started with targeting Tupac's godfather, Geronimo Pratt, who was head of the Los Angeles Black Panthers. He tried to lead the COINTELPRO team to kill Geronimo Pratt, but instead they only end up framing him for 2.5 decades. He was falsely imprisoned. The government ended up settling a case with him in the mid to late 90s. But he ended up going back to that area, San Francisco area. Well, at first he was in L.A. targeting Pratt. Then Pratt was in jail in the San Francisco area. And so Held was supervising that area when there was 3 attacks on Tupac. Now, Held also was supervising that area when Huey Newton tried to lead the defense of Geronimo Pratt to get him out of jail, and Huey Newton was assassinated. He was the founder of the National Black Panthers. And so then there was 3 attacks on Tupac, and all of the kind of tactics used were documented by Judy Barry, the tactics that Held was specialized in. So it was 3 armed attacks against Tupac, basically, in the years while he was living in that area. But Tupac was actually head of the New African Panthers at 18 years old, before he ever became a rapper. And he only gave up that leadership, the New African Panthers, which was active in 8 cities nationwide, in order to go on tour with Digital Underground, and then, of course, break with that solo debut record. And so, of course, Tupac said when he made that record, "I never had a record until I made a record," because the police stopped him for jaywalking, choked him unconscious, and then smashed his head against the curb. And I showed 2 articles on how people died in police custody from those police tactics. So, it just goes on from there.
It's a insidious and repetitive story, isn't it? Same thing you see over and over again throughout the decades?
Yeah, I do. And, of course, you played Jimi Hendrix, that song by Jimi Hendrix, and I saw the different tactics used against Jimi Hendrix. His manager said he was a former MI6 agent, which is, of course, British CIA. And, and I argue all the things he did and the different things he had, like, Cayman Island, offshore accounts and different things like that, showed that he was a current MI6 agent, and he had set up this within about 48 hours of Jimi Hendrix firing him. Jimi Hendrix was dead. And somebody actually came out with a book within the last year or two saying that he admitted, Mike Jeffries, this MI6 agent, or former MI6 agent, whatever you want to say, admitted to him that he had Hendrix killed. And now the guy says, you know, Jeffries said it was just because of insurance reasons, but I show lots of evidence that it was really for U.S. and British intelligence to get rid of Jimi Hendrix because he had turned very seriously left, you know, and radical politically, and was starting to back the Black Panthers, and he was starting to start, you know, he was starting political movements, trying to get Bob Dylan involved with him in, you know, in a radical political movement he wanted to start, and so it was time to get rid of him.
Music can be a very, very dangerous thing.
I agree, and I argue the reason is because it wins over people's hearts and minds. The CIA and MI6, they want to control people's hearts and minds.
It goes past logic when you're listening to some music. You go into almost a trance, and you absorb things that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to. It's like going under the influence.
Yeah, but you also, you know, kind of fall in love with that artist if you love his music. If you love his music, you want to follow everything he does, and you want to, you know, hear what he's saying. And people, you know, fell in love with Jimi Hendrix. They fell in love with Tupac. That's why they were so popular, you know, like other artists too, of course. But these are artists that got, you know, so political that it scared U.S. intelligence and British intelligence about how much they could sway populations, for example, against the war, which Jimi Hendrix tried to, you know, do an anti-war benefit, and Mike Jeffries dosed his drink and messed up his performance. So, you know, there was a number of ways I could, you know, tell you how, you know, these intelligence agents tried to ruin their activism, these artists' activism.
I went under the assumption that this kind of FBI tactic of going after famous people who have a lot of sway, who speak out about stuff, is not isolated, and nor is it over by any means. I mean, I think, for example, Charlie Sheen, what's happened to him recently, he had his cars stolen, all of this stuff, all after coming out and saying 9/11 was an inside job.
Yeah, I agree with you. I can't say I've investigated that and have enough proof of it all, but that is their modus operandi. And so they psychologically profile these guys, and I do have a chapter on psychological profiling and how they tried to do that with Tupac. They tried to do that with Huey Newton. They tried to do it with a number of different activists that they tried to do that with. They take a profile and they say, what's the percentage, you know, percentages on him reacting a certain way in a certain situation, and then try to kill them based on that. And I believe they did that with Mumia Abu-Jamal, too. So now, of course, the first time they tried to use it against Huey Newton, they weren't successful. They basically rented an apartment right next to Huey Newton's. They had a black guy in there that they raided the apartment and you know, at 5 in the morning and tried to draw Huey Newton out. But Huey Newton figured that it was a ploy that was to draw him out to shoot him and kill him. So he didn't take the ploy. But with Tupac, they tried to draw him out of his car in Atlanta by beating up a black man near him, and they didn't get him out of his car, so they ran to his car, and, you know, it was foiled, but they still did almost kill Tupac by shooting at him while he was in his car, rolling out of his car. And with Mumia Abu-Jamal, they, of course, you know, put him on death row, but they basically beat his brother bloody within earshot of him. He, you know, he heard his brother scream, and he ran for his brother, and all of a sudden, Mumia Abu-Jamal was shot. And he should have, you know, the attempt was to kill him. You know, a guy in jail, you know, signed an affidavit saying, I was hired to execute, to kill this cop. And someone else was, you know, was hired, of course, to shoot Mumia, and it was made to look like Mumia was, you know, did the shooting, but also to try to kill Mumia. And that was the fallback plan, I argue. But either way, with Charlie Sheen, you know, if they profile him and his habits and what his weaknesses are, you know, it's easy to get him on certain things. You know, his maybe problem with drugs or his problem with women, you know, his, you know, whatever, going after certain women or whatever else it might be. They put people around him, possibly even put undercover agents around him. I'm not sure with his case because I've investigated fully. But it's, you know, obvious he was the most famous spokesperson on 9/11 Truth, so I could see that possibly happening.
Yeah, yeah. And you saw this, even if you don't look into it, you see a saturation media campaign, and that's usually what kind of confirms it for me. If it's something that's kind of irrelevant, or somebody has come out for something as substantial as 9/11 truth, you see two very, very different approaches by the media. If they come out for 9/11 truth, they go in the media all the time, but it's because of one bad reason or another bad reason or another bad reason, like throwing mud at them to see which will stick.
Right.
And it gets to the point where people have had a bad image of one person repeated in front of their eyes so many times that they can't help but believe it.
Right. It paints them as irrational, and it paints them as someone you can't believe about anything. But, you know, here was a guy who was very successful. He was the, you know, top TV star in the country, and they turned him into someone who seems irrational.
So I think he was mistaken when he thought he was big enough to survive going public like he did.
Yeah, it's not easy. And he's got an activist family. His father was a strong activist, too, anti-war activist, and activist for the poor, Martin Sheen. So it's a shame that he was attacked the way he was. But, hopefully he'll bounce back.
What about your family and parents and things like that? I mean, did that help you in some way become sort of the investigator that you are?
Yeah, well, my father was an anti-war activist, you know, an anti-Vietnam War activist. He was a doctor, and he was trying to organize doctors against the war, and he was actually involved in a group called the Catonsville Nine, if you ever heard of them, in Baltimore. The Berrigan brothers were famous anti-war activists who kind of broke into a draft office, you know, grabbed a bunch of draft files and poured blood on them and burned them. But he was active. My grandfather was a Marxist lawyer, and my mother was you know, radical lawyer herself. So they influenced me. I didn't really care that much about activism growing up, but then got into it more in college and after college, mostly after college. Yeah.
Why, was there something in college that made you think, man, there's some BS going on here?
In some ways, yeah, because I had a poetry professor named Dennis Brutus, who was a South African dissident who, was very active and very inspiring. But it was more so just investigating things after college, just working in the city, going to different activist meetings and learning more and more, and, just trying to figure out what's going on in the world. I slowly but surely became more and more, active and radical. So.
See, it's amazing. If you go out and you keep listening to activists and radicals, you become a lot more active and radical.
It's just being open-minded to a different point of view, and then weighing the evidence from one point of view against the mainstream media point of view. And it's just trying to be open-minded, and then you say, well, the evidence is so, seems much stronger, this radical alternative point of view. You know, I didn't actually, I guess I was just open-minded to it because of my family, but I didn't care about it at first, but then being open-minded to it was enough. For example, in my
was
book...
Was there a clincher issue for you that just clicked you and just go, you know what, I can't live a normal life anymore?
I can't say there was any clincher issue. It was just a slow, gradual change. I do remember just something as simple as the presidential election of Dukakis versus Bush. Bush was former head of the CIA director, and Dukakis was just some guy from governor from Massachusetts. And the way Time magazine covered the election, I happened at that point, I was just a mainstream Democrat and was working on the Dukakis campaign, and I saw the way they portrayed Bush as such a sweet guy, and he was former CIA director, ruthless killer. And Dukakis was, just this well-meaning Democrat in some ways, though who knows, how well-meaning he was. But the way Time magazine covered it, I was like, this is bullshit. This is total bias, trying to portray Bush as a wimp and Bush as soft and Bush as sweet and Dukakis as, ridiculous or hard edge or something, whatever they put on it. So just, like that made me question mainstream media and get, And so I have two chapters on the media that I'll go into after the break.
We're coming to break. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with John Potash.
just in time. Head down the 405. Gotta meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta work to feed the soul. But I can't do this all on my own. Superman. I'm no Superman. No. You've got your love online. You think you're doing fine, but you're just plugged into the wall. And that deck of tarot cards won't get you very far. There ain't no hand to break your fall. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta know just when to fold. But I can't do this all on my own. No, I know I'm no Superman.
Exposing just a little bit of scumbaggery. The show that's bulletproof. The show that shoots laser beams out of his eyes. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We also have Freezing Breath, for which we can put people like Dick Cheney in cryostasis forever. My very special guest today is John Potash, and we're talking about, well, an interesting array of evidence that seems to suggest that, yes, indeedy, the FBI has a big program that is specifically out to get anybody of famous influence that starts speaking the truth and has the ability to sway decent amounts of people into action for good. So what kind of a person do you think would authorize that sort of activity?
Well, definitely racist, bigoted, wealthy people are behind all this. And they, you know, when you look at the start of the CIA, who by the National Security Act of 1947 were made, the CIA director was made the supervisor of all the other intelligence directors. The CIA was founded by the wealthiest families in the country. The Bushes were behind them, the Rockefellers, the Harrimans, the Mellons, and people like that were all involved. And so they were both incredibly bigoted against, particularly against blacks, but against, you know, people of other, you know, religions and color in general. But they were also incredibly hyper-capitalist. You know, they wanted to hoard their wealth and keep their wealth and not give any of it to, you know, let any of it drop into anyone else's hands. So anyway, they founded the CIA, and they directed, you know, they end up directing all these operations, or at least okaying all these operations. But the FBI's counterintelligence program, we found out about because of the fact that activists broke into an FBI office in 1971 and confiscated thousands of FBI documents that first exposed what was the counterintelligence program. And they tried to spread them to all the media. They tried to create their own media, get the word out, you know, that they'd found, they'd gotten all these documents. And so the word did get out a bit, but, you know, of course, mainstream media tried to cover it up a bit, too. But Congress ended up being forced to investigate, and we had the Senate Church Committee in 1976 came out with even more exposés about what was really going on, though even that was, it was published, but not, it didn't get out to the people. And that's because, of course, the media, mainstream media, by that point was so controlled by the CIA. So the Church Committee in 1976.
You were saying that the mainstream media is controlled by the CIA. Is that Operation Mockingbird?
Partly, yeah. It's probably Operation Mockingbird was the start of it. It was buying up media assets. But they had already bought up a lot of media companies. And I'll tell you the different ways it works. You know, the Church Committee in 1976 came out with the fact that well over 400 members of the media lived dual lives in their work for the CIA. Now, these weren't just regular journalists. These were the ownership of the media. Now, you know, Carl Bernstein, that Watergate muckraker, was famous, you know, in the early 70s for bringing down Nixon. But by, you know, around that time of 1977, he couldn't publish his article covering what the Church Committee came out with anywhere but in Rolling Stone magazine, which was not very big at that point. It was an independent magazine at that time. And so he published an article, a famous article called CIA in the Media, where he showed all this. He said, you know, he listed the owners of all the media and how that these congressmen found that these guys were living dual lives in their work for the CIA. Virtually all of mainstream media ownership was doing this, was hand in glove with the CIA, he said. Now, another way they controlled the media was what University of California at Berkeley Dean Ben Bagdikian came up with. He found in his investigations that the top media companies in our country have boards of directors that are interlocked with the banks, the insurance companies, the oil companies, the defense contractors, etc., and the pharmaceutical companies. So by sharing boards of directors, he says, by corporate law, they cannot do something that hurts the profits, the stock profits of their dual companies. So it creates automatic conflicts of interest that they have to support each other.
It means it becomes impossible for any good to be done in society, basically.
Very, very hard, yes. Yeah. And so, and then a final way, which I have in my film, too. I have an 85-minute film based on my book with the same title, FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. But in the film, I also show the how Noam Chomsky came out with a book with University of Pennsylvania professor Edward Herman, who's a professor at the Wharton School of Business. He came out with a book analyzing the media, showing, you know, manufactured consent, which you probably heard of. But their book showed that the Pentagon in it was 1980, I believe it was. Or I'm sorry, I think it was the 1970s. They found that the Pentagon owned some 113 different media, periodical titles. And then they found by 1982 that increased to over 1,000 different media titles, journals and magazines were owned by the Pentagon. So the Pentagon was putting out over 1,000 magazines.
There was an act passed. I think it might have been the Military Commissions Act or the Media and Communications Act or something like that, passed by Clinton, and it lifted a restriction that prevented basically one media company from buying up all other media in its area, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they lifted that, at the time there was like somewhere around 800, I think, media companies across the United States, give or take, mm-hmm. and it's now 5.
Yeah, it's incredible how the ownership, it has 95% of the media, they say, now are basically controlled by the umbrella companies of about, 5 media companies, they say, yeah.
And as you say, these board members are interlocked with the entire military-industrial complex as
right.
well.
Right,
so it's lock, stock, and barrel. And this is the reason why I refuse to go to the mainstream media to ask them to cover issues or even care about them or whatsoever. This is why I bullhorn them and call them useless, pathetic scum who lie to everybody at protests and things of that nature, because they are owned lock, stock, and barrel. And we better realize that they are not our allies. They haven't been for quite some freaking time. And we have to create our own media to counter them, not suckle at their teat, not wait for the scraps from the king's table.
Yeah, that's why I think, you know, programs like yours are so important, Vinny. But I still use the New York Times and all the mainstream, you know, periodicals and newspapers around the country. I was doing my research in New York, where I could use the New York Library, which gave me access to every local newspaper in the country. I was lucky that way, so I could get the Atlanta Journal-Constitution daily newspapers, Atlanta's daily newspaper, on the exact evidence of what was going on in court during that incident I described earlier where Tupac was shot by the Atlanta cops. But the New York Times is supposed to be the standard bearer of newspapers in this country. Now, of course, I show, in some ways how they do a lot of cover-up, but in some ways they do. At the end of their articles, Chomsky says this too, at the end of their articles they sometimes put a little truth in there. And if you go do that and you get a little bit of truth amongst all the fabrications, you can, use that, quote that, and, show that's why, like, most of my footnotes are from mainstream media organizations, but they're teased out of these, you know, like kind of cover-up stories in the first page that just get a little bit into the truth, you know, in the page A16 or something, you know.
It's like going prospecting, you know.
Right.
Just got
right.
Your pan, and there's a hell of a lot of dirt, but there are tiny little nuggets of gold in there.
Right, right. But I also got, I did a Freedom of Information Act request to get Tupac's FBI file, and they, I paid, you know, for, they told me, and a Department of Justice worker told me that there's over 4,000 pages in Tupac's FBI file. And so I paid for them all, and I got the, you know, in the Justice Department's letter about that, and they only sent me 99 pages for national security reasons, they said. And even those pages were blacked out in lots of parts.
So. I hate that. And I remember this one time. Have you noticed how everybody's so really, really overly secretive about stuff? I remember one time I was a telephone salesman, and these people were so, so protective that they actually got somebody to run through a 200-page phone bill and black out every single line.
Oh, wow. That's something. That's a waste of taxpayer money there.
You'd be surprised at how insane people can be when money or psychopathy is their only motivation. Are you willing to stay with us for another hour, John?
Yeah, sure, no problem.
All right, we'll be back in about 5 minutes or something, so make sure you go have a cup of coffee and take a wiki leak. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
The belly of the vulture, watch your back. There's no civilians, women, children, front lines, listen. Consider this a distant early warning. The fire's imminent, pollution gathering dust particles funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation too fed. Check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.
That song there is by is called Unity. It's by a New Zealand band called Unity Pacific. The lead singer is a friend of mine, Tingiala Ness, and he was actually part of the Polynesian Panthers here in New Zealand. So I think that's actually quite an appropriate song given the subject matter, don't you think? John Potash is my guest. And John, would you be so kind as to give out your website so people can access more of your information? Is your documentary online by chance for people to see?
It is. You know, I sell it too because the person that put it online on YouTube, it's just very blurry there. And so when you get the DVD, you know, if you buy the DVD on Amazon, you can read the actual intelligence documents that I have in the in the documentary. But it's www.fbiwaronTupac.com, and you can get more information, on different aspects of the book and see. 10-minute of film compilations of film excerpts from the movie. So, and it's also in both English and Spanish. So, if you happen to get out to any Spanish-speaking audiences for any reason, you know, if anyone's knows any Spanish speakers, they can play it for them that way.
The closest thing I can do that is with my dirty Mexican accent.
So anyway, but it's just interesting. It's incredible how much control they've developed over. all forms of media in our country. It's very sad, but I just opened up my book and I saw this one quote from a former CIA agent, Ralph McGahee, who obtained a CIA memo in 1991 when he was still working at the agency, where the CIA boasted they had representatives in every media outlet in the country who could help them spin and censor the news. So our media is so sadly controlled that way by all these different operatives having too much power in all these different media organizations.
Okay. Is there a light at the end of the tunnel to all this?
Well, the light is that, you know, alternative media keeps popping up. It may not last because it's independently funded, like out of our own pockets, but it keeps popping up, and it gets truths like these out. Like your show, for example, obviously, I mean, I think different 911 truth publications are getting different, you know, news accounts out on a number of different subjects. There's a lot of organizing in the cities in different ways, and groups are rising up all over the place trying to get a different, you know, a version of what's going on out there. And then there's just some good, a whole lot of good groups rising up. For example, Fred Hampton Jr. is the son of the famous Chicago Black Panther, Fred Hampton, who was assassinated by U.S. intelligence. So Fred Hampton Jr. started a group called the Prisoners of Conscience Committee, and they're active nationwide, and he happened to write an afterword for my book. But he is doing great organizing in Chicago, and some of his comrades are doing great organizing in other cities. And there's, you know, the New African People's Organization was the kind of the parent group of the New African Panthers that Tupac led, and it's made up of former Black Panthers and former Republic of New Africa activists. They're active around the country in different ways, and there's lots of different groups that are doing good stuff that I think combined hopefully are going to have an effect and change things for the better.
It's what I've termed the tactic of the cactus. Cactus protects itself by covering itself in spines from every single direction, so no matter where it's attacked from or pushed from, whatever it does, it will get a little prick. And I think that's what happens with the information war that's going on right now. There's a certain branch of information for one person in one particular area for which they are an absolute expert on. That one person in that one area can now be amplified with alternative media so that it gets across a lot of different mediums.
Sure. But I think a really good thing that you're doing, and the Occupy movement's starting to do this more and more, which is really amplify, you know, people of color's issues too. It's not, you know, the white owned and white controlled media doesn't always do that. I had a lot of problems getting in the, you know, white media as much as, you know, the black media. Finally I had a breakthrough with British woman who works at WBI Radio in New York, it's Pacifica Radio in New York, who interviewed me for the evening news twice. And so, you know, it just takes certain individuals to really push hard, you know, in the more white-dominated media. But, it's good that people like yourself and others are, you know, look beyond race and aren't as brainwashed about issues like this and don't think this is just something crazy coming out of the black community, the fact that, Tupac Shakur could have been targeted by COINTELPRO, by a latter-day COINTELPRO.
And the other side of the thing is, you know how these COINTELPRO, they probably want to listen to this show, and they probably are right now for all we know, but I just think about it like this. Let them watch. Let them listen. Every moment they do, all this information, all these analysts that they've got doing all this, across all these different spectrums and disorders, I think what's going to happen is partly our propaganda in the truth sense of the word, is going to start working on their analysts, their agents, and things of that nature. Yeah. And inexorably, we'll start to gain moles on our side. We'll gain trust. We'll gain whistleblowers, things of that nature. It's an exponential curve, I find. The truth has such power that it is capable of overcoming almost any obstacle.
Yeah. Yeah, I had some guys, when I did a lecture in Vermont, I had some white guys come and just start heckling me throughout my talk, and And they were pretty vicious. And then one of them said, and so, you know, my good friend is a CIA recruit right now, and he tells me blah, 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 blah. And so it was obvious, you know, who had sent them. But I basically just tried to win them over and said, I understand where you're coming from. I used to think something like you're thinking now, but slowly but surely, you know. And so I explained to them how I evolved, and they were nice by the end of the talk. It was kind of strange, but... nice to, you know, it was good to see them evolve a little bit to stop heckling me, you know. So, yeah, I think it can happen. I agree. Just like you said, I think people can evolve no matter what position they're in, you know. But at the very top, it's, of course, it's hard to completely change the mind of the head of the CIA or you know, the one of the Rockefellers, et cetera. But, you know, the people underneath them, yeah, we got to agree. We think we can change their minds.
Yeah, yeah, and of course it's mostly by the complicity and of the general population that these CIA directors and presidents and things of that nature can get away with the lies and murder and drug running and things of that nature. So it gets to the point where you think about critical mass, and I've said many times, and hopefully I'll keep being able to say it many more times, that throughout history, if you look at positive revolutions that have been successful, generally it's been done by a very small, determined percentage of the population. American Revolution was like 3-4%. You know, it's the same story.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. So, you know, even if it's a slow, gradual revolution versus, you know, a fast revolution, it's just, you know, I hope even just an evolution of people's minds would be enough for me. But, but you know, they don't want even the evolution, obviously, so they're trying to kill off anyone who's helping people evolve. But hopefully they're just going to try. I mean, like with people like Naomi Wolf, who wrote The End of America, she says they're messing with her mail, they're messing with her phone, they're messing with some other things, but, you know, not... She hasn't had any physical attack yet, so hopefully, you know, it's going to be, you know, we're going to have to worry about physical attacks. I just think if everybody who hears this does their little part in any which way they can, it's going to help the, you know, the cause in general.
Yeah, but, indeed.
What are you going to say, Vinny?
I was just going to say, it's like the good thing about Naomi Wolf and so many other of these high-level activists who are having this kind of stuff happen to them is that they are so dedicated that they don't shut up and they don't go around. They, in fact, broadcast the fact that these attacks have happened to them.
Yeah.
And as a result, I believe it creates a protective blanket upon them because it makes it a lot more difficult to take somebody out or to sabotage them when they are 100% aware that they're in a position to be sabotaged, kind of thing. It's sort of like it's impossible to spring an ambush if your prey knows it's about to be ambushed.
Yeah. But, of course, then there's people, you know, that reach the top and then have too much power and are going to have too much power, like Robert Kennedy. He said that he knows that there was, you know, before his death, he said, I know there's, you know, loads of CIA guns between me and the White House, but I'm going to keep going anyway. And I have a chapter on him in my book just because of the fact that believe it or not, there's an overlap in that the main people that were behind the scenes in Tupac's assassination were some key cops, undercover agents in the Ramparts Division, which is one of 18 Los Angeles police divisions. The Ramparts Division was notoriously involved in CIA activities because they were the ones that cleaned up all the evidence in Robert F. Kennedy's assassination. And in a strange coincidence, in 1996, there was a photographer that shot the pictures of Robert F. Kennedy being assassinated, of the gunman shooting Robert Kennedy. And he brought a case against the government to get his footage, because his footage was confiscated from him when he took that footage. Finally, in 1996, his case was coming to trial for him to get that footage, and it was against, you know, he was targeting particularly the Ramparts Division. He said the Ramparts Division took my camera and took my footage, and they must still have it. So he finally comes to trial. He finally got the fact that they still had the film, and then when the, you know, when the film was being taken to the courtroom, they said they accidentally lost the film. But this was the summer of 1996 when Tupac Shakur was being targeted. and some of the key people in doing the targeting were in the Ramparts division. So a Los Angeles columnist said, what in the world is going on with this case on this RFK film? Why is the city using outside lawyers, private lawyers on the outside, instead of their 100 lawyers they have in the city government to handle this case? And I argue the reason is because they had so many intelligence operations going on at that moment with Death Row Records that they didn't want anything like that exposed. Because the case with Death Row wasn't just about killing Tupac, though of course that was, you know, a major issue. It was also about drug trafficking. It was also about gun running. You know, it was there was a number of things that were going on inside Death Row Records. And, you know, one of them, a key one, of course, was to kill Tupac in order to partly say that the Crips killed Tupac, arm the Bloods, and, you know, and have restart the Crips versus Bloods versus Crips gang war that had been, you know, resolved, that had stopped because of the Black Panther activists and Tupac. And so they did restart the gang war. And there was a lot of killing on the week and during the week that Tupac was in the hospital, because people thought, you know, the Bloods thought the Crips killed Tupac. And then, say after Tupac died, activists convinced them that it wasn't the Crips that killed Tupac, and they stopped fighting each other. But there was a number of different operations like that going on at Death Row Records. And so that's why I think... So that's why I think they were covering up what was going on in the Ramparts Division 1996 around the film, hiding the film on RFK's assassination. Now, with RFK's assassination, there's a number of good books on that, but Assassinations is one of them. But they show just the huge cover-up. I mean, he was shot. Evidence is still coming out. There's a great British filmmaker I forget the name of his film now, but he showed that there was, you know, he showed the CIA agents that were at the scene. There was more bullets that went off. Sound specialists, you know, heard the explosions in the film of RFK's murder, you know, assassination, and he found there was more bullets shot than there was in Sirhan's gun. Martin Luther King's attorney, that William Pepper, is now taking on the case of RFK, and he got a Harvard professor to say that, you know, to analyze Sirhan, and he believes that he was hypnotized and didn't even know what was going on then when he did the shooting. And the leading evidence is that it was a CIA operative that shot RFK from within an inch of his ear. I mean, the guy who did the autopsy said that the bullet came from a gun within an inch of behind RFK's ear, and everyone, all the witnesses said that Sirhan was in front of RFK and not closer than 2 feet from RFK. So it's just a load of evidence that the Ramparts Division helped cover up to the CIA in that assassination.
We talked earlier about modus operandi kind of thing, and you take 9/11 and you take Tupac. Okay, 9/11, allegedly, terrorists destroyed the towers, and then it's a big war on terror against these other people. Same thing. Tupac, he's the tower. He gets destroyed, and they blame it on the Bloods and the Crips, and then they've got a war.
Right, they do that, and they also pretend like it could have been the East Coast versus West Coast rap war. And so then when they kill more political rappers, they say it looks like it's another, you know, part of the East Coast versus West Coast rap war. So they use different possibilities, and they pretend like those are the reasons for more deaths, too, you know.
And again, using back the 9/11 analogy, now Al-Qaeda, which is funded and basically founded by the CIA, is popping up in Libya and Syria and all of the, and Iran and all of these other places and destabilizing the regions. So modus operandi.
Yeah, I mean, the leading evidence from history is that the Al-Qaeda came out of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. They were Muslim soldiers that the U.S. funded to fight against the Soviet Union. So, that's where they came out of, and they pretend like the Mujahideen then turned on the U.S. and attacked the U.S., And, you know, the evidence just says otherwise. I agree. I think they were just still working for the right-wing element of the U.S. And, you know, of course, the right-wing element now, sadly enough, includes the neoliberals who go along with it. But that's where we're at with that. I agree with your analogy, though.
Indeed. We'll be right back after the break with John Potash, ladies and gentlemen. Also, check us out at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. We rely on your donations and subscribers for $5, $10 or $20 a month, whatever you feel like donating. There's a bank account number there too at the homepage of thevinnyeastwoodshow.com if you support what we're doing here. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and assassination, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. And also, knowing all this stuff can also, at times, weigh very heavily on your mind, be very stressful and occasionally depressing. And so it's also a very bright idea to develop coping mechanisms so it doesn't actually really drive you insane. And that's what the whole comedy element really is for. It's to help everybody, you know, deal with this kind of stuff, because it's harsh, man. It really is.
Yeah.
And if you want to you know, have a choice between listening to this kind of information and you want to hear it in a very nice, easy, happy, fun way, your choices are very limited. On the other hand, if you want to listen to this kind of information in a incredibly fear porn type sense of the word, then, oh my God, is there a kid in a candy store ideology for you available in every single language in every single country? and it's not just limited to the mainstream or the alternative media. Isn't everything really just about giving ourselves a little bit of mental masturbation on that fear porn motif? Do we love being afraid or something like that? I'm not sure what your take on this is.
Yeah, well, I think I really like your genocide light. It's like Holocaust with half the calories, you know? I definitely think, you know, you got to make fun of this crap. This New World Order, you know, fear the boogeyman, you know? It's fear Al-Qaeda. They always need the fear factor. They always need the enemy that's going to come, you know, take your life, take your money. And it's because they have, you know, a different way of thinking. I love the fact that they hate your freedom. That's the best one. Al-Qaeda, you know, hates your freedom, and they want to take away your freedom because they hate it. They hate freedom. So, it's really amazing with the shit they put out there. See, I'm sorry, am I not allowed to cuss, because I'll get you in trouble with FCC or something.
You might.
I hope you can bleep that out. I hope you can bleep that out.
We don't have a bleeper, unfortunately.
So I'm just so sorry. Leave it in.
But I will apologize to the affiliates and all those people. I'm sorry. I hope you're over 18 and an adult about this.
Yeah. So I had no more cussing on this program. But it is amazing. I do love how they do that. They use all kinds of protect the children, which is really, I think, another word for protect the people from, you know, any kind of radical discourse is what they're really trying to do, censor for, you know, against radical discourse. But you know, just about 911, I'll say if any of my fans tuned in and, you know, aren't into the 911 truth stuff and they don't realize it, just think of the fact that, you know, World Trade Center number 7 fell in free fall, and you know, about 8 seconds, and over 1,700 architects and engineers who have architects and engineers for 911 Truth have said that it must have been controlled demolition. You know, buildings don't fall in free fall without a controlled demolition, and for that it takes weeks, if not months, of planning to set up all the bombs. You know, to get at the undergirders, like even Dan Rather and Peter Jennings said, anyone who knows, how you make a controlled demolition happens, which they said this looks exactly like a controlled demolition, they know you have to get at the undergirders, which means, get the bombs in the basement to cut a thermite in the basement to cut through the steel. And so it's just, there's so much evidence about that it had to be an inside job to get in there and set up the explosives, set up the thermite and all that to take down those towers. But I talk about the 911 in just a page or two because I didn't have time to get into all that, but I just talk about in terms of whatever I end up saying whatever you believe about 911, after 911, the New York Police Department became the world's police. New York Police Department actually was found in, this is in mainstream media, they say it, we're going into other countries and policing other countries. That's how powerful the New York Police Department got. The head of one of the top CIA guys ended up being one of the top New York police intelligence people. So it's incredible the apparatus they set up in New York after 911.
I think that the 9/11 commission was the thing that I found was very interesting because it's so similar to the Warrant Commission. In which case they had evidence that wasn't allowed, secret, all this, that, and the other. It's just totally controlled. I find that's very similar with almost any real bad incident where we suspect government involvement, is they always appoint a committee to prevent any investigation.
Yeah. I mean, one of the congressmen that was on that committee resigned in protest because he was one of the only honest people on the whole committee. Said that their whole investigation was being stymied by the Bush administration, and he's congressman that's
there was six people out of the 10 on the 9/11 commission came out and said that they were set up to fail.
Yeah, a number of them did say that, and one resigned in advance though. But I agree, a number of them, even one of the lead lawyer consultants for the 9/11 commission wrote a book saying the whole thing was being stymied from a real investigation. So, the whole 911 commission was a joke. And the 911 trials were a joke, except the fact that one or two kernels of truth did come out. I think it was Leon Panetta, head of transportation, said that he was standing next to Cheney when a guy every 10 minutes would come up to him and saying, it's 50 miles out, the order still stand, and Cheney would say yes, and that's 10 miles out, 5 miles out, and Cheney says, I said they still stand down, and he's talking about whatever was coming at the Pentagon, and of course whatever hitting the Pentagon's a questionable issue, but it's the most protected airspace in the world, and so obviously they let something come near the Pentagon, so...
Yeah, and also any cover-up, you find it all tapes and records and photos and everything that's ever taken of an incident or whatever always gets confiscated by guess who? The FBI.
Right.
And it's never seen again because they're so adept at pursuing justice that they need to make sure that nobody can see it being done.
Yeah. Now, after 9/11, there was a ramping up of attacks of any political rappers in the rap industry around the country. And just to get back to my Tupac book, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, what came out in the Miami Herald, the Miami Daily newspaper, is the fact that the New York Police Department had a rap unit that was training other police departments around the country to have their own rap unit that targeted rappers. Now, they said it was to target corruption in the rap industry, but people started dying after these trainings happened. In Miami, when they showed the timeline, rap industry figures started dying just after their police unit was trained by this rap unit in New York. So the center for all this, this targeting of political rappers was happening mainly in New York, but also in Los Angeles. So it just does tie into...
Well, this is actually part of the reason why I bring political rappers on this show as well.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And have you noticed how political rap has kind of started to... Everything evolves, haven't you noticed? Particularly when it's to do with art and the industry. Mm-hmm. And yet... It seems as though the mainstream kind of performers and things of that nature that get the big chart toppers and whatever, they seem to devolve and get dumber and dumber and dumber.
Yeah.
And yet the underground rap and things of that nature seems to evolve and get more clever. The rhymes get better.
Right.
The information gets more real, you know?
Yeah, like Immortal Technique. And, you know, it just so happens Immortal Technique, Mos Def, and Eminem happened to come out with that 911 Truth video. I don't know if you saw that about you know, Bush brought down the towers. You know,
I've heard the song, but I haven't seen the video.
Yeah, you know, it's good because it's got all the lyrics played out, and it's got images that go along with the lyrics. It's well done. But and then Mos Def was targeted after that. Eminem was visited by the Secret Service, probably I think because of that, and probably because of his Mosh video, which has people attacking the White House, saying Bush, started the Iraq War for no reason. And so, it's just the Immortal Technique, of course, stays underground, and he still puts out great stuff. But I agree with you that you can only really find it's hard to find good rap in the mainstream rap, good political rap.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like politics is something that I think is intensely interesting to me because I actually give a frack about my country, my world, and my own life and my liberties and whether or not they're going to be taken away. Yet mainstream society, I think, has been very much co-opted to ensure that only the soulless, only the foolish, only the vacuous seem to get that superstar status because those are the ones that they want people to idolize, kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just actually it's one of those things that there's little events in the 1990s that allowed some radical music to get into the mainstream, like Rage Against the Machine. But with 9-1-1, Rage Against the Machine songs were banned. And you had just different other things occur, like with Kurt Cobain was actually a radical leftist. And I'm not going to get into that, but he actually did have a lot of radical political causes, that he supported, and I get that into this in my next book, but there's just a load of evidence about that he didn't really kill himself. But there's just there was a little window in the 1990s, and in the 2000s, especially after 9-1-1, it's just that window's closed a lot. A lot of stations were bought out. Two out of the three top movie theater chains were bought out by the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group was associated with the Bush administration. A number of right-wing political figures were part of the Carlyle Group. I don't know if you ever heard of that, them, but Cheney and Bush and all. It's just they basically now control. They bought the second of the three top movie chains after Michael Moore's 9-1-1 movie came out. Within a week of it, becoming a blockbuster, they bought out, another movie chain. So that's why we have such, terrible movies here, and it's really hard for any political movies to get out in this country.
There have been a few squeezing out I've seen, and what I found is also there's a lot of symbolism in films. I'm a big movie buff. I watch lots and lots and lots of movies, and I see the same things going all the way through them, same characters, same storylines. It's all revamped. And something that I've noticed of late is a noble terrorist character, somebody who is against the government, who does illegal things for the greater good. And this character I've seen is starting to kind of pop up a little bit more to the point. It's like,
good.
I don't think it's like a genuine trying to wake people up to the reality of the government. I think it's more like a trying to get them sort of adversarial about it so that they'll be angry and or afraid.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Oh, I'm not 100% sure, but it dovetails with the amount of end of the world movies that have come out in just the last 5 years alone. Pick your apocalypse, Contagion, zombies, giant waves. The whole way of films has now changed, and it's remarkably negative and becoming a lot less artistic.
Yeah, well, Hollywood is probably one of the biggest arms of the propaganda of you know, the U.S. intelligence, but I think there is some maverick directors that do, you know, of course, like Oliver Stone and some others that do try to do something a little different and do try to get some,
Mel Gibson.
Some decent... yeah, I don't know what to say about Mel Gibson, actually, but...
The film The Patriot, have you ever seen that one?
No, I haven't seen The Patriot.
Have you seen Braveheart?
Seen Braveheart, yeah.
Well, you know how Braveheart was really kind of
parts
like,
of it. I think actually, I don't think I've seen the whole thing. So I'll trust your take.
Well, I'd highly recommend seeing both the Roland Emmerich film. He did Independence Day and 2012. He also did a film with Mel Gibson called The Patriot, and it was really a well undervalued film for its time. It was spectacular the amount of insight it had into the founding of the United States, the principles of liberty, freedom, racism, slavery. The brutality of the English and why you overthrow tyranny and why you don't jump into war and
did he write and direct it or did he just star in it?
I think he played a major role in those capacities. Yeah,
yeah.
And again, just like with the Charlie Sheen thing, he comes out and he says all of that kind of stuff, and then all of a sudden he's getting demonized for being anti-Jewish and all over the place. I don't know the full story or anything like that, but again, modus operandi.
I don't know, but
there might be something to it, and we'd just have to look into it further in order to suss out the evidence, I suppose. We'll be right back after the break for the final segment with my incredibly special and fabulous and marvelous guest and various other nice adjectives, John Potash. Back in a minute, ladies and gentlemen.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand. And I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
That's the CIA.
I've been to Reno, Chicago,
song.
Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow.
These are the local stations at KVBL that they have their operatives, you know, controlling and producing behind the scenes kind of thing. Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, back onto the very special guest that we have here. I don't want to waste my time with him. John Potash. And I'd like you to give your website out one more time, and then I've got a question for you.
Sure. It's www.fbiwaronTupac.com. And so I hope people, the book and the film are, more information about the book and film can be found there. Of course, it's sold on Amazon.com. But support your local independent bookstore if they sell it. And please donate to Vinny Eastwood's show because we need independent media like this out there. And, can't be valued enough, Vinny.
Well, that's another thing I wanted to do is, you said your documentary is online, but it's in low quality, right?
Yeah, online it's in lower quality, but, so if you have it...
Because I've got I've flicked you an email, and I've got a professional YouTube account and an unlimited broadband connection. So if you send me a copy of the DVD, I can put it up in full quality for you.
Okay, well, thanks, Vinny. Just if you have it, if you put it on your DVD player at home, you can just see, you know, you can read the documents in the film much easier, or on your computer at home, you can read the documents on there much easier with the DVD through, you know, having it directly. But I think, the book just has over 1,000 endnotes documenting all the sources, and then the film shows, pictures of the pages of the actual sources and the people that the book talks about as the sources and things like that. It's got court documents. I got over 1,000 government and court documents on the different trials of Tupac that show for example the sex abuse charge. What he was actually convicted of was touching this woman's butt against her will. He was found not guilty of sodomy, attempted sodomy, assisting sodomy. only touching the woman's butt against her will. And for that, he got 1.5 to 4.5 years in jail in a maximum security prison. And I argue they did that to mess his mind up, because they kept him in solitary confinement for 10 of the 11 months while he was in jail. It's a way. And the Amnesty International showed that there's different penal coercion tactics that are used against political prisoners to mess their mind up. And one of them is the solitary confinement. And others that were also used to show that all 8 tactics that they investigated were used against Tupac while he was in jail to mess his head up and get him to believe that maybe Biggie had something to do with, you know, his shooting in New York. And at that shooting in New York, a security guard said that he took the film of the lobby where Tupac was shot and offered it to police. He said, you know, we got this on film, the shooter's on film. They denied, they wouldn't take the film, and they closed down the case. So it's just a little more of, you know, another attempt on Tupac's life.
Mm-mm.
By U.S.
Now, the last question that I'd like to ask my guests before we run out to the end of the show, it's about self-censorship. And you know how, for some reason or another, particularly if we might be on radio or something of that nature, there's certain things that we won't say because they are really far out and maybe the audience won't quite comprehend what we're saying, or maybe the host might judge us a little bit or something like that.
Sure.
So, any researchers or things like that I have on this, I like to give them the opportunity. If there's anything of that nature that you wouldn't ordinarily say, if you think you might be judged, I won't do it. And if you think the audience might not get it, trust me, they're pretty bright and they will.
Yeah, well, I guess, I'll say I didn't get, in my next book, I'm going to get more into the whole start of eugenics movement in this country, which started in the early 1900s, and it basically was started by the wealthiest, just to throw it out there, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, not to smear all white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. It just so happened that this group, the Carnegies, the Harrimans, the Rockefellers, the Bushes, you know, ended up being intermingled with that group. They started the eugenics movement in this country, and it was an incredible attack, not just on people of color, but it was Jews, Italians, ethnic people in general, a number of immigrants. They called Jews and Italians, they said 60% of them are inferior and needed to be sterilized. And they passed laws in 30 of the 50 states around the country stating this. And a New York Times top writer published a book about this called War Against the Weak. And a guy named Edwin Black, he had been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize 10 times by his New York Times editors. But this information in particular, he wrote the book IBM and the Holocaust, which so happened, which did get, did become a bestseller. But his other books were just as important and didn't get out there. And so he documented how this movement, the eugenics movement, just, even though it officially ended after World War II, it was still around and still, you could argue it's still around in different forms to this day. So it targets, incredibly bigoted movement against a lot of people that aren't, part of this group, this supposedly elite WASP kind of Aryan group. And so this is a war. It's partly a class war, of course, and it's partly a bigoted war against people of color and people of, ethnic leftists in general. So, I think that's what we're dealing with here. And I'm sure I self-censor in some ways, but, in some ways I think it's because I just don't have enough evidence to support what I would, say in different ways. And for other reasons, maybe it's because the mainstream media, I'm sure, is affecting me in some way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always like to hypothesize and take stabs in the dark. And even if you don't have any evidence, you'd be surprised how much you can figure out if you just start thinking about it out loud.
Yeah, and that's why I end up getting to to obsessively research, the topics of this book. And then,
what'd you take, mate, like a whole decade on it? There must be some kind of obsession there.
Yeah, sure, there's a little bit of it. But I still, I worked part-time at times and, full-time at other times when I needed to, but just kept, researching and writing on the side. And it just, to me, this topic was interesting enough. And to me, also, I would say that Tupac and Bob Marley and Jimi Hendrix were just people that weren't covered in, in the kind of trove of research on political assassinations, and they needed to be covered. So I cover the, you know, MLK and Hendrix and the Panthers, but then I also cover, you know, Marley, Hendrix, and Tupac, because so many people love them for their music. I thought it would get them to find out about this alternative history in general, and hopefully inspire them to become activists. And, you know, I think it's worked a little bit, at least, you know.
There's many roads to the truth, aren't there?
Oh, sure, yeah. A lot of different ways to go. You can do it, you know, with books, you can do it with song, you can do it with a great radio program like you have, Vinny. You can do it with poetry, and, you know, you could do it just, you know, going out and getting involved in the protests and trying to influence the people around you. So many different ways to do it, but I hope everyone gets more active after hearing things, you know, topics like this, programs like
this. Well, that's the great thing about conspiracy, because it's all connected. It's like ice cream. Everybody's got a flavor that they just love and can't get enough of.
Yeah. Yeah, and music is just a fun one. You know, it's a fun one to, so now, you know, when you listen to some Tupac's old, more political songs, you can, you know, like Holler If You Hear Me, you can dance to it and appreciate it for its, you know, political education. When he says we got money for war but can't feed the poor and things like that.
Yeah. And it's the same thing over and over again. It's whenever an old great idea like freedom or a revolution or something, it becomes forgotten about. When it returns, people think it's new. They think it's revolutionary, but it's the same thing we've always seen before. It's the same tyranny that we've all seen before. History is just littered with tyrannies that have risen up and killed heaps of people and then basically been overthrown. And I think this is going to be one of the interesting ones, because corruption and tyrannical scumbaggery seems to be perennial throughout history. And I think that with the technology we have and the capacity that we have for getting truth out to mass awareness levels, we might actually be able to educate a population to the point where they will educate each subsequent generation to be vigilant and to watch out for the warning signs and make sure that this ugly type of system that we're living in right now never rears its ugly head again.
I sure hope so. What do you think, Vinny, about how bad U.S. is getting and how much New Zealand is getting just as bad? Or is New Zealand better than the U.S. right now? I actually got a friend out there who I'd like to visit, but it sure is tempting to change countries if this country gets too bad.
Well, look at it like this. You know how they call it a new world order?
Uh-huh.
Name me a country that's exempt from that definition.
I understand.
Same stuff happening over there, man. Same stuff happening over here.
That's a shame.
It's a shame.
But you're getting on some radio programs over there, like in Hamilton and places that are getting some good information out there, right?
Yeah, man. Well, dig this. It doesn't matter where you live. There's always good people somewhere that are willing to do the right thing. And I think that if you put your neck out there, not only do you become a target for the bad people who might want to stop you, but you become a lightning rod that will attract all the people that want to see you succeed. And Don, I want to thank you so much for your time and all the good work that you do.
Thank you so much, Vinny. Keep up the good work.
I'd love to have you on again sometime, man.
That'd be great. Thanks a lot, Vinny.
All right. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to join us in the chat room at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com for the after the show chat we're going to have, you can just join us right in there about now. See you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. And you don't go changing on me.